Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and President Obama's announcement of his first presidential trip to Israel happens to coincide with the release of a new insider account of President George W. Bush's dealings with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Let's compare and contrast. The book is by Elliot Abrams, who supervised Middle East policy for President Bush. He's now with the Council on Foreign Relations and teaches about U.S. Middle East policy at Georgetown. He also made headlines and raised eyebrows recently by suggesting on NPR that Chuck Hagel, President Obama's defense secretary nominee, appears to be not just anti-Israel, but an anti-Semite. We'll talk about that later in the interview. Elliot Abrams' book is called Tested by Zion, the Bush Administration and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Mr. Abrams, thank you for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
One of the main points in your book, as I read it, is to argue against the conventional wisdom that everyone knows what a final status agreement between Israelis and Palestinians will look like, and that both sides simply need enough courage to go there, that the maps are well known, the compromises on right of return in Jerusalem are well known, the Palestinian security responsibilities are well known. The failure of the talks at the end of the Clinton era was just that Arafat, as an old-line protest leader, couldn't say yes. So how much of that do you believe or not believe?
Well, I think courage is certainly going to be needed on both sides. But basically, I think you've expressed it correctly. That is, I've heard a lot of people say for years, oh, you know, they're an inch away. If only there could have been another week or month of talks. They were just an inch away. And I don't think that's right for some of the reasons that you mentioned. I mean, on Jerusalem, for example, coming to an agreement on Jerusalem is going to be extremely difficult. They're not an inch away. Security matters are very complicated. And again, they're not almost there. They're not just at the edge of peace. Unfortunately, they're further away from that.
So what do you think happened in 2000? Wasn't Israel ready to sign on in 2000 and 2001? If you write that both sides, and I'm quoting from the book now, both sides see what a compromise must look like, and neither side appears to want it. Wasn't Israel ready to go there at the end of the Clinton administration, and Arafat wasn't?
Well, I think that it is true that Arafat said no, just as it's true in 2008, January 2009, that President Abbas said no. But, you know, by the end of the Barak period, he had lost a great deal of the confidence that the Israeli public had had in him. I think that, you know, the one-sentence summary of this is that the most that Israel is able to offer right now is less than the least the Palestinians are able to accept right now. I think that's still true.
It seems like your and President Bush's approach was to dismiss the idea of a peace process altogether. You use terms like peace process in quotes often, and dismiss that, and you know that anything like that had to do with negotiations between the two parties, and you put it on the Palestinians to make internal changes as the road to a Palestinian state, to demand reform as the price of Palestinian statehood. So I want to play a minute of a speech that President Bush gave in 2002 that I think lays this out pretty well. Let's go back 11 years.
I call on the Palestinian people to elect new leaders, leaders not compromised by terror. I call upon them to build a practicing democracy based on tolerance and liberty. If the Palestinian people actively pursue these goals, America and the world will actively support their efforts. If the Palestinian people meet these goals, they will be able to reach agreement with Israel and Egypt and Jordan on security and other arrangements for independence. And when the Palestinian people have new leaders, new institutions, and new security arrangements with their neighbors, the United States of America will support the creation of a Palestinian state whose borders and certain aspects of its sovereignty will be provisional until resolved as part of a final settlement in the Middle East.
President Bush in 2002. My guest is Elliot Abrams, who was the Middle East policy advisor to President Bush and author now of Tested by Zion, the Bush Administration and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Did you write those words for him?
No, I actually did not write those words for him. But I'm very glad you played those lines from the speech, because it was a critical speech. And what Bush was actually saying there was, we cannot take the position that we wish to create a Palestinian state led by Yasser Arafat, corrupt, a terrorist, without caring about what will be happening inside that state. In other words, it's not just the borders that matter. It's also what is the nature of that state. Of course, we're June 2002. We're within the same year as 9/11. So the question of terrorism is very important. The previous position had been that of President Clinton, which was, we will give Yasser Arafat a state without much concern about what is happening within those borders, either from the point of view of terrorism or from the point of view of human rights. So I think that what Bush was doing in saying the nature of a Palestinian state is critical to us, to Israel, and above all to the Palestinian people, was the right way to try to move forward.
Because ultimately that would be more in Israel's security interests. If there was already what you call a government mentality in the Palestinian areas as opposed to a resistant mentality, then they would be moving naturally toward what a state would actually function like. And then it would be easier for Israel to go there because they wouldn't be as worried about terrorism?
Well, I think it's not just Israel. It's Jordan, and it's the United States. It's the neighbors of that Palestinian state that would have the prime interest, but we would also have a great interest, since Israel and Jordan are very important allies of the United States, in not creating, in 2002, a terrorist state in the Middle East.
Why, by the way, is Israel an important ally of the United States in your view? I know we always say that, but the United States has military bases in Persian Gulf, Arab countries, practically, you know, client states there. There may be an intrinsic value to supporting Israel's security, but why is Israel important to the United States?
I would argue that a key reason here is, first, that it's a democratic state. Second, that it is a firm U.S. ally. That is to say, the alliance with the United States does not depend on a strongman or dictator or king whose views can change or who can be replaced overnight. The alliance with the United States is actually based on the views of the people of the country. So we know that it is not going to change.
But to do what? To accomplish what for us? Because I think some Americans think that, well, the United States does and does and does for Israel, and it's very politically necessary to be in strong support of Israel in this country. Maybe you heard about that Saturday Night Live routine that didn't quite make it to air the other night about what, you know, mimicking what people might have wanted Chuck Hagel to do to demonstrate his support for Israel, but politically necessary in this country. But what does Israel actually do for us that makes it such an important ally?
Well, over the years, one can point to a number of things. One of them is, for example, the stability of Jordan, to which Israel is a great contributor and has been over the decades, including preventing at one point a Syrian effort to overthrow the king. So I would point to that. I would point to the fact that Israel's stability has been a contributor over the decades to stability in Egypt since 1973. I would point to the fact that it was Israel, not we, who eliminated the Syrian nuclear weapons program in 2007, which was certainly a benefit to the United States. And I think we, you know, if you think about the where we would all be in Syria today, if in addition to everything else there were a nuclear program, that was quite a boon for us.
Although you say Israel contributed to stability in Egypt since 1973, that was mostly under Mubarak as a dictator. And I think one of the and I'm curious to get your inside take on one of the conflicts that I think was very essential to Bush administration foreign policy. President Bush gave some very moving speeches about democracy and trying to move to a democracy agenda, democracy-based foreign policy, when he acknowledged in one particular speech that I think he may have given in 2005, that U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War included supporting so many dictators because they supported us, but that that had come back to haunt on 9/11 and, you know, among other ways. And yet it's a very difficult standard to continue to meet because you do have elected governments who might be extremely hostile or even dangerous to us. And so I wonder if you could talk about that dynamic in the administration.
Yeah. Well, I think that what President Bush had right completely was the analysis that those regimes, Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, were less stable than they appeared, that if we were banking on them to remain stable, we were wrong, that sooner or later the people of those countries would seek democracy. Now, we did not think that it would happen nearly as quickly as it did. We were talking about a generation. We were not talking about months. But the fundamental analysis, I think, was right, that we make a mistake in building a relationship with a country on one individual, on a dictatorship, rather than trying to get those countries to move in the direction of democracy. Your point is quite right. That's easy to say. It's hard to do when the dictator, the head of the regime, is in fact pro-American in a situation where there are other military, security, economic, financial, trade interests. I think Egypt is a good example of this, because I think if you go back to 2004 and 5, we were actually pushing Mubarak pretty hard on human rights issues, and there was progress in Egypt. And then we pretty much stopped in 2006, 7, 8, and there was a regression in Egypt. Egypt was a worse place from the human rights point of view in 2006, 7, 8 than it had been in 2004 or 5. And I think the reason was that American pressure was diminished. The reason the pressure was diminished, by the way, was the peace process. That is, as we moved forward with an effort on the Israeli-Palestinian front, of course, people said, well, you know, you need Mubarak and you need his foreign minister and you need them to cooperate with us on Israeli-Palestinian issues, where they had been pretty helpful. So let's ease up on the pressure on human rights.
So you wanted the Palestinian leadership to start developing a functioning government there, in effect, and less of just a resistance mindset, as you put it, as the path to normalcy and then a Palestinian state. And you have praise in your book for at least one Palestinian leader along these lines. You say Prime Minister Fayyad is trying to create a moderate, responsible Palestinian politics. How is he doing that?
Well, let me just go back for a sec, because, you know, where the story begins is January 20th, 2001. Bill Clinton hands over to George Bush, and in the White House, in the Oval Office, on Inauguration Day, does a diatribe against Yasser Arafat and against ever trusting him and negotiating with him. So what the United States and the quartet, U.S., EU, UN, Russia, tried to do was to marginalize Arafat, to create a real Palestinian government with a prime minister who was Mahmoud Abbas, create the post, fill the post, and begin to create a government. Fayyad was at that point finance minister. Later, when Abbas became president, Fayyad became prime minister. Well, I think if you look, first of all, look at the finances. This kleptocracy that existed under Arafat does not exist. You can look at the Palestinian budget online now, on the web. If you look at the security forces, they've built a reasonably decent police force. If you look at the government ministries and institutions and the reports on them from the World Bank, the IMF, what they're saying is they're moving in the direction of creating the institutions of a state, which is really exactly what we wanted. They didn't have that under Arafat, and they are having more and more of it now.
So are they there yet, in your opinion, if the goal of the Bush administration was to develop the kinds of Palestinian governing institutions that you were just referring to, and then they'd be ready for statehood?
Well, you know, I give a one-word answer to that, yes, in the sense that I don't think that's the barrier to statehood at this point. The barrier to statehood is that the Israelis and Palestinians don't have enough common ground to reach a comprehensive agreement, which is why I argue to try to take incremental steps, partial steps, because I think, frankly, that's all that's available. It would be much better if they could do a comprehensive agreement right now. I just don't think that's realistic.
My guest on WNYC is Elliot Abrams. He supervised Middle East policy for President Bush, and he's the author now of Tested by Zion, the Bush Administration and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. One could read your book and conclude that almost everything you write about the Palestinians' political shortcomings is true, but still wonder why you see so few shortcomings on the Israeli right. You repeatedly dismiss the expansion of settlements as an issue, even though they complicate the map of any negotiated agreement. You don't acknowledge in the parts that I read the growing problem with the ultra-Orthodox that many Israelis see, including their concentration in the West Bank and their belief that the land was given to them by God so they can never, you know, be compromised by human beings. Is it wrong to say you see Palestinian dysfunction clearly, but the Israeli right's dysfunction through rose-colored glasses?
I think that's an unfair remark for one reason. First, at Camp David, Barak offered a generous peace agreement. The Palestinians said no. 8 years later, 2008, Olmert offers a peace agreement, even more generous than Barak had offered. The Palestinians again say no. Now, you can argue, well, but that's the past, and now Israel has a right-wing government that isn't offering peace. And then you have an election. You have an election, and everybody predicted, oh, well, this is a walkover for Prime Minister Netanyahu. But actually, it looks as if centrist parties were strengthened. Secretary Rice and President Bush always used to say that if the Palestinians were really ready for peace, politics, democracy in Israel would solve the problem on the Israeli side, because they would force the election of people who also wanted peace and a coalition government that wanted peace. And I think we've actually, in a sense, seen that happening, that when Israelis feel that their government should be more flexible, that's how they vote. And that appears to be the way they just voted.
But isn't that still a reluctance to say anything about the settlements or the way the government has managed the settlements? Will you say anything critical of Netanyahu policy?
Yes. I think that, for example, Netanyahu has done some very good things in the West Bank in eliminating checkpoints, barriers to movement. He should have done and should now do more of that. I think it's a mistake ever to suspend the financial payments. These are the Palestinian taxes that are collected by Israel. They should be turned over on a regular basis, or you're badly disrupting the Palestinian Authority's finances and its credibility. I think there are too many raids in the West Bank. I wish more of that would be left to the Palestinian police working in conjunction, as they often do, with Israeli security forces. So there are a number of things that I'm critical of on the part of the Netanyahu government. The fact is that historically, on two really important occasions, Israel offered a comprehensive peace deal, and it was not accepted.
I want to get to the Chuck Hagel thing before we run out of time. The Armed Services Committee is scheduled to vote today. Maybe it already took place, I don't know, on his nomination to be defense secretary. And you made news on NPR before his confirmation hearings, saying, quote, "I think he has a chance at his confirmation hearing to show that he is not what he appears to be, which is frankly an anti-Semite. It's not just being anti-Israel. He's got a problem with what he calls the Jews, the Jewish lobby. I think if he cannot satisfy people that he is not, in fact, bigoted against Jews, he certainly should not be confirmed," unquote. So that hearing took place. What do you think now?
Well, I was actually overseas and didn't see a lot of the hearing, but I must say the hearing seems to have left many people, left, right, and center, with a dim view of the nomination. I wish the president had chosen somebody else for this post, and I think an awful lot of Democrats and Republicans on the Hill probably do, too, at this point. It's not up to me. It's up to the senators. They'll vote, but, I wish the president had chosen someone else.
Do you wish you had chosen different words in characterizing Chuck Hagel?
No, I think the problem here is that the organized pressure of the organized Jewish community in support of Israel is either legitimate or not fully legitimate. And his words over many years have given, I think, the strong impression that he views that organized community pressure as not legitimate. And I think that's terrible.
Where do you get that? Where do you get that impression? Not legitimate is a very strong term as compared to saying he thinks they have too much influence, he thinks they are wrong on the issues. To say that he feels that fundamentally the idea of a pro-Israel lobby is an illegitimate thing, like different from any other lobby. There are a million lobbies in Washington, as you know. Where's the evidence for that?
Well, first of all, there are statements that he made. I actually wrote a long piece about this in National Review about this question. And I think there are a number of quotations from Senator Hagel. The famous ones, I'm a United States senator. I'm not an Israeli senator. My oath is to the Constitution. There's also some language from Jews in Nebraska about his attitude toward the organized, not individuals, toward the organized efforts of the organized Jewish community. And there are no statements on the record, I believe, by him about the organized efforts by Greek Americans, Cuban Americans, Armenian Americans. It just seems to be this one group, and I think that's very unfortunate.
The Daily Beast did a piece that responded to you, and it referred to where you cited the testimony of several members of the Nebraska Jewish community who go on at great length in an article for what they call a far-right-wing Jewish newspaper. And when you said, and the record seems unchallenged, Nebraskan Jewish activists and officials have said he was hostile, and none, including Obama supporters and Democratic Party activists, have come forward to counter that allegation, unquote. And Daily Beast says, except the unanimity Abrams relies on simply does not exist. Late last year, the Israeli-born Rabbi Arya Azriel of Temple Israel in Omaha, Nebraska, wrote the local paper to note his long friendship with Hagel and recounted the defense chief designate's visit to his congregation. The next day, Azriel told the Huffington Post that the anti-Semitism accusations against Hagel were, quote, extremely stupid and definitely not helpful. So does that refute your argument about Nebraska?
No. It refutes the argument that there is no rabbi or single Jew in Nebraska who likes Chuck Hagel. But this is not a question about individual Jews or about Judaism. It's about the organized Jewish community, and I think there have been other articles since the Daily Beast article, which have gone back to some of the people originally quoted, and they've repeated the statements they've made. Look, I think everybody understands there's a problem here in the relationship between Senator Hagel and the Jewish community. It's very unfortunate. And
but again, when you say the Jewish community, if he's criticizing AIPAC or the organized right-wing Jewish community.
No, look, I just don't buy it. I'm sorry.
Than being anti-Semitic, isn't it?
Of course it is. First of all, I reject your accusation, which I think you just made, that AIPAC is part of the right wing. AIPAC is the largest pro-Israel lobby in the American Jewish community, and it is firmly bipartisan, and it has said nothing about the Hagel nomination. So first of all, that's unfair to AIPAC. But this is not about whether you think policy A or policy B is the correct policy. It's about whether this kind of organized lobbying activity is fully legitimate. I think that's the question.
Elliot Abrams, he was chief Middle East policy advisor to President Bush, and he's at Georgetown in the Council on Foreign Relations now, and he's the author of a new book called Tested by Zion, the Bush Administration and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we continue our Oscar series on the five best documentary nominees. Today, the director and producer of the very influential film Invisible War, about sexual assault in the U.S. military.